Hello, everybody, and welcome to Minute 106 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Dave Pallas of 5 Minutes of Mystery. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hello, Rob. Thank you for having me on. I just got back from the Jersey Shore, so I went from nice sandy beach weather to Christmas Eve in Washington, D.C., getting ice blown while I'm trying to jump out of a chopper. It's a real whiplash.
Well, isn't that the way you're supposed to do it? You know,
I didn't pack for this. I packed for the beach.
Well, again, that's part of the whole fun of it all. You don't pack, and you deal with it as it comes along.
I need a line for this, Kev.
That's true. All right. So hopefully you'll be prepared for the rest of the week.
That's I'm freezing on the tarmac. One of the two.
Something like that. Or on the wing of an airplane. Something like that. You know what? I got an idea. How about we just wing it this week? How's that? Maybe that'll work. We're going to be winging it, everybody. So enjoy that. All right. So minute 106 begins with John making his pitch and ends with Esperanza trying to keep hold of the plane. So basically, we ended things on Friday with John doing his best to try to stop the 747, the cargo plane that the bad guys are trying to get away in. And, you know, what better way to do that than to try and convince a crazy helicopter pilot to put the plane in its path? But, he didn't really want to agree. So John had to try and think of something else. And this minute begins with him coming up with a new idea. And he decides that he's going to, jump onto the wing of the plane, for whatever reason. I don't know. The script writers.
I am so surprised at that moment. Right after he jumps, I assumed Sandy and her cameraman would have been like, this is news, baby. Like, we're the only ones with the exclusive scoop that LAPD officer in this movie, John McClane, is hanging on the wing of the plane trying to stop the terrorists who are I'm just saying, it's just so funny how I'm so surprised that Sandy Coleman is like, oh, good luck, John. And she's not like, record that. Hit record that now. Leaning out of the helicopter. Now the journalists are actually, if it wasn't for Sandy's crew having a helicopter, if they brought a van that night, this wouldn't be happening.
That's true. That's a good point.
Esperanza and the guys would have gotten away. So we got to thank Sandy and her team for hey, is it a snowy blizzard in Dallas? Yeah. All right. Let's bring the chopper. They're just the camera guy's like, the helicopter pilot's like, yeah, I'll fly you and your camera crew out tonight. Yeah, sure. Midnight at an airport packed with people coming in. It's such a, 4 hours earlier, this was such a no fly zone. And now it's everybody's got to land. And this chopper has the entire runway to itself right now. They're getting such an exclusive that journalists can't ever they can never fly over an airport.
Thornburg would be eating his heart out right now if he knew that Sam Coleman and her crew were the ones who were able to get the shot. I'm stuck in the plane.
Yeah, he's probably I'm sure if there's an air marshal would have handcuffed him by now to the seat. Yeah.
he's I think just pissing it in his pants. I think that's what he's doing after being zapped like that.
Screw you, Dick. That's what I think. That's so funny. God, that's insane. When you guys were talking about just the absolute chaos, he's, not even thinking straight. You're like, yeah, I would call it. And how he embellishes it, too. He wants to wax poetically about, because he did the first movie, too. How he's, the fraternity of having terrorists attack your city. What sick way of, to describe that.
But that's Richard Thornburg for you. What can you do? Yeah. So John is trying to stop the 747 and he screams, hang on. And then Sam grabs him and goes, what are you doing? She's trying to talk some sense into him. Right. And he turns to her and goes, you wanted a story, didn't you? Nice and easy, boys. Get me in low. And, you know, he's telling the pilot what to do. And at this point, you actually see that the cameraman picks up his camera and starts to film. I mean, remember, those big-ass cameras of the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, you have to carry on your shoulder. But in this cramped helicopter, you know, the guy still puts it on his shoulder and does his best to film John. You know, maybe he was hoping that it would make it onto Faces of Death or, the Faces of Death they had back then, but I don't think they had the Darwin Awards yet, because Darwin, this would probably fit into, John survived, so he wouldn't have, you know what the Darwin Awards are, right?
I would assume it's kind of like what the stupidest thing you could have possibly done type of video. Is it like next level America's Funniest Home Videos?
No, it's worse. It's basically an award that is given out. I don't know if it's a real award or not, to the person who died in the dumbest way over the course of the year.
Jesus.
You know, I think two seasons ago we talked about that there was one of the winners was a guy who like put balloons on his beach chair and ended up he crashed.
Oh. And,
you know, there's a whole bunch of them. I mean, anyone could go and look it up. There's a whole website for the Darwin Awards. I don't remember if they did them all the way back in 1990, but you know, this cameraman is probably not thinking that he's going to get a scoop. I think he's saying, I'm going to have good film footage for something else. Have you ever seen Faces of Death?
I mean, like, yeah, back in my like teenage years, and I remember like late night TV had kind of like the VHS, like, you know, you won't believe. These are the Faces of Death on VHS for, you know, four easy payments of $89.99. You know, some like, you know, they give you a box set of like, you know, eight VHS tapes for like $100 or something. I remember that being like a kid, being like, whoa, it's so metal, and being like trying to, you know. But no, I've kind of moved past that. I don't need that.
Right. No, I wasn't asking if you've seen them recently. I remember, I think it was probably in 1990 or 1991, a friend of mine and myself, we said, oh, we're going to go watch Faces of Death. You know, oh, we're going to go rent it. And we rented it. And we were like, because we had heard all the stories about Faces of Death, you know, that, you know, honey, stay away from that bear. And then you hear like a big roar and then a guy like fly by, you know, things like that. I mean, for people who don't know, Faces of Death is a cult video series that they made in the 80s showing live footage of people dying. Right.
Yeah. It's
and
like,
so my
it's
friend like and I, we, you know, that's right. Snuff films are murder. These aren't necessarily
true,
murder.
True. That's true.
Dying in crazy ways. So, I mean, I know that my friend and I, we were both like 16, 17 at the time. And we're like, yeah, we're going to go watch Faces of Death. And remember, we put it on. And during the credits, they're showing like a heart operation or something like that. So within like 2 minutes, we turned it off. We're like, okay, that's enough. We can't watch this.
Intense, guys.
It was too much. So I have never seen Faces of Death. I've been tempted to go back and rewatch it now that I'm a little older and can probably stomach things a little better. Except for the fact of knowing that it's all real. So I don't know.
Yeah. I want my crazy violence very fictional. Way too much reality and violence in the world
exactly.
today. Yeah. I just want to see John playing shoot terrorist guys.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. I think that's the way to do it. Just wait for John McClane. That's it. You know, we'll get a nice death this later this week, but we'll get there. And so, you know, the cameraman is filming John, and then we get an external shot of the helicopter actually descending towards the plane, which I got to say is a really cool shot. I mean, the fact that they really did this with, on the commentary, so Renny Harlin mentions that this plane is the only real plane that they use in the movie. Everything else is a model, but this one is real. And the fact that, you know, so apparently they did the real stunt of having, you know, a helicopter come close by and, you know, having the stuntman jump from the helicopter onto the airplane wing itself. Obviously,
and also,
it's not really
they had the another helicopter above this helicopter to film that helicopter. So like that stuntman that does the jump has two different rotor watches hitting him when he hits that wing.
That's right. That's very true. I mean, nowadays they would just use, you know,
A drone.
Exactly. That's the word I was
looking for. It would use a drone, and it would CGI the plane. So it's like it's a static wing on a green screen, and they would just have, right. You know, they're just, you know, I mean, they essentially, it would be the Fast and Furious 6 ending, where it's just like a giant CGI plane on a CGI runway with a fight scene that goes on for like 15 minutes. At least with this, like, you know, we know the plane's slow because it's warming up and he's about to jam the wing, but also, it's only like about 5 minutes between when he jumps on the plane to when he's off. It's like almost five real minutes. Whereas I think in Fast 6, it was like almost 10, if not 12, maybe 15 solid minutes of the third act is them having three different fight scenes on this plane.
Right. It's true. But I still like this one better. Sorry.
Oh, no. I'm
like practical effects more. You know, I'm more of a practical effect fan. Just, yeah. Even though I'm not CGI doesn't look cool and green skin, it looks really cool. You know, yeah. but knowing that someone really jumped.
That is, yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. So yeah. John does his best to try and figure out a way to work his plan. Even though Sam is still trying to stop him because she goes, "Where are you going?"
I mean, yeah, she's right. It's like they're going to knock, knock. The guys are going to let him in. He says, "Can you guys please slow down?
That's right. But the funny thing is, she's the only one protesting. The other four guys are not saying anything. You know, you got the sound man, the cameraman, and the pilot. They're like, "Okay, let him go. We're good. Go ahead and jump, John."
That's one thing we haven't thought about is like, okay, the one thing that, I mean, I'm sure you talked about this earlier in the film, so remind me, but like, we have not addressed those federal officers since like minute four of this film. So it's like those federal officers were supposed to take Esperanza into custody, you know, when this was supposed to be a normal
Christmas. You're talking about the Department of Justice guys, right?
Yeah. Okay. Those guys.
Right.
So those like those suits are probably just still sitting in the lobby, like probably trying to make calls, being like, "Oh, hey, by the way, you know," they're trying to call probably their own FBI. I have 100 questions all about that, and I'll save them, like piecemeal them out through our
week here. I can actually tell you where they are because they showed them when Blue Light showed up. So those guys all were there to greet Grant and his men. And when they had the debriefing in the pilot's room or whatever it was, pilot's lounge, I think they said. So they were there also. So we have seen them. They're not still sitting in the terminal, you know, saying no comment.
But obviously the moment when Lorenzo and McClane go, "Yo, those are blanks. Grant's men are in on it," and that whole when the actual like ruse is being revealed, I assume that the State Department, who they probably never called, or they made the one call and Grant's men picked up, like those State Department guys are like, "What? Our own counter terrorists are with the terrorists?" And they're just like, "Oh God, my job got so much worse tonight." Like their job was supposed to be escorting Esperanza into custody, and then now it's like, "Oh no, our plan B was also part of the terrorist plan," and like they must try to be calling like FBI and like everybody. I that's another thing is that like I have to assume that there's got to be a military base that's starting to like warm up jets to be like, "Where you say Esperanza is about to take off? I think we're gonna have to do something drastic about that." Like, you know, like I have
right. Well, I mean, you're bringing up some great points about the fact that, you know, I mean, we talked about this months ago, and we don't have a clear answer, obviously, as to how they actually, how did Trudeau call? How did he know who to call? You know, it's like, how do you pick up the phone and say, "Okay, we have terrorists here. You know, where do we go with it?" I mean, there were. I brought up a list of 10 different anti-terrorist units that theoretically could be used. But again, I don't think Trudeau would have known who they are. You know, no, he wouldn't have said, "Okay, I'm going to call the FBI or I'm going to call SWAT or whatever it is." I mean, they sort of glossed over that aspect because, you know, like on the one hand, they don't want to raise panic by telling everybody. But on the other hand, someone needed to give off information at some point. So I think you're on the right track here, though, that maybe they went and spoke to the people of the Department of Justice. And they said, you know who you need? You need Blue Light. These are the guys who are going to do it. You know?
Yeah. Like I said, I want to go into this. I don't know if you want to save these topics for later in the week. But, like, I have a lot of questions about how Stewart and Grant, you know, how they planned this out. And, like, you know, they said, like, weeks of – as this bronze says, weeks of planning. I am very curious how they planned it out, that they were able to, like, get to these places.
We'll break it up. Let's break it up over the course of the week, because I think those are great things to discuss. You know, some of them are stuff that we've touched on, but, you know, we'll go through it and see what else we can try and figure out, because there's a lot that they leave for us to try and figure out on our own.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of unanswered questions here for sure.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. So then we see the helicopter getting close to the wing, and then Sam screams, "You'll get yourself killed. Come back inside." And he goes, "Bring it in low. Keep over the wing. Lower." You know, and he's basically shouting. It always amazes me in movies how, you know, it doesn't matter how much noise there is, people can still hear you.
Yes. You know? Over. Yeah. You know, this, you know, honestly, I'm just saying, with John being, like, scared of heights, I feel like right here is where he kind of solves. If he didn't solve most of his fear of heights jumping off Nakatomi, I feel like he also solved it here, jumping from helicopter to wing of plane. You know, like,
that's right.
Because he doesn't know that if he doesn't get to that wing and do something quick enough, they're going to take off and he might be hanging on for a, you know. So it's kind of like, that's a hell of a, like, conquering a fear of flights. I know they, and when he gets to Live Free or Die Hard, he's like, "Oh, I did some helicopter training just so you can fly a helicopter." But I have to assume, like, after this, he's like, "No, I'm good with heights now." This is, I mean, like,
what makes you think that he has problems with heights? He never mentions that he has problems with heights.
He doesn't like flying.
He
doesn't like to lose. He doesn't like flying. Doesn't like to lose. And just obviously the fear when he looks over the rooftop, like the few times he's up on the roof in Nakatomi. So I just always took it as, and he keeps saying, "Oh, please, oh God, let me die." And obviously, if you had to jump because you know the building's about to explode and you have to take your risk on a fire hose, like, you're not going to be calm, cool, and collective. I 100% agree. Every 10 out of 10 people or 100 out of 100 people are going to probably do the same thing. Took it as, like, because of flying, and him jumping off the building, I always took it as he's got a fear of heights. He's the opposite of Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise probably looks at a building's roof and goes, "Ooh, that's interesting." John McClane goes, "Nah, I don't want to be there." So I just feel like,
okay, I never thought about that.
Surrounding him in an airport where he's happy to be on the ground, but he knows that, yeah, now push come to shove, I gotta take to the air, and yeah, I gotta get on a wing of a plane and figure out what I'm gonna do.
You see, I have a different take on it. I think that John isn't necessarily fear of heights is what, agoraphobic, right? So I don't think he's agoraphobic. I think he's okay. He's more claustrophobic. He likes being in a place where he can have control of what's going on. And being in an enclosed aircraft, you know, is what would theoretically make him, you know, that's his fear.
Okay. You know? I
wonder what you would call the fear of losing.
I mean, like, that's just kind of like the fear of, like, yeah, losing control and being out of control is kind of like general anxiety. And him being a cop, he's probably so used to, like, yeah, making sure that when he's in the room, he makes sure order is established. So having to be like, you have no power here in an airplane. If it's crashing, it's crashing. Nothing you can do. If flashing a badge is going to help. So that could be just general that. That's part of why his marriage was on the rocks in the first movie, was he had this fear of kind of like losing control of his family because he didn't put enough trust in Holly that she would be a successful businesswoman out in L.A. He thought that was going to hurt the marriage, but really it's his attitude about it and not trusting her is what really was hurting the marriage when they had that fight in July, as she says.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about it from that perspective.
That's all I do. That's all I do is think about these things. But I don't have.
I think a lot of them. Until you bring me on. Exhausting. Yeah, there you go. It makes sense. There you go. So as the helicopter gets really close, so John, or actually the stuntman, makes a jump, and we hear a big scream as he's landing, and you know then he lands on the wing, and the first thing he says. We can hear him say, "John, what the f*** are you doing on the wing of this plane?"
He had to get ahead of the audience on that one, because we're all like, what is your plan?
That's right. He doesn't really know his idea here. And then, you know, he looks over and decides to take his jacket off, and, you know, ram it into something. Now, do you know what that's called of what he rams it into?
Oh, gosh. I mean, if you told me, I'd just say the wing flaps, the the hydraulic wing.
Right. Well, that's what I thought also. I thought it was the wing flaps, but it's called an aileron, A-I-L-E-R-O-N, which is a French for either little wing or for a fin. It's a hinged flight control surface, usually forming part of the trailing edge of each wing, and they're used in pairs to control the aircraft in a roll, which normally results in a change in flight path due to the tilting of the lift vector.
Okay.
So apparently if it's not closed, you have a little bit of a problem. You know, you can't take off without it. There is a little bit of controversy as to who actually coined the term or the idea of using one of these, right? And it's the Wright brothers had a legal battle with someone named Glenn Curtiss as to whether the way that they created the wings in order to achieve lateral control, you know, who thought of the idea, the Wright brothers or Curtiss? Mm. And apparently they ended up finding out that Curtiss basically kept stealing their patent for his things that he was using.
Oh.
So, you know, it was the Wright brothers who really invented it, theoretically, from what we understand. And basically, when World War I broke out, they needed to start using it, you know, on other planes and stuff like that. So they
of course, dogfighting, you know, yeah.
That's right. They got permission to do it. So, yeah, I mean, it's actually very cool, the idea that John even thinks of doing something like that. Like, if I was on a plane like that, I don't think I would have thought, okay, I'm going to go jam the aileron, which I never even heard of before today, actually, because I always thought it was the wing flap or something like that. Maybe it is. Maybe it's also referred to as the flaps. I don't know. But, you know, that's the official name of it. And, you know, we'll even get tomorrow, one of the characters even mentions it. So, you know, and I never caught that. I never caught the real name of it, you know, beforehand. So he jams his jacket in there, and then the shot changes, and we see Esperanza, who begins struggling with the controls, you know, and once again, we'll go back to the idea that, okay, this is a guy who was just shot in the arm an hour ago, and he's still able to handle a 747 without a problem, and we see the blood stain, you know, on his arm. Of where,
yeah, I guess he had wings. Surprisingly.
That even though they did bandage him up, I mean, we had John Leguizamo a few weeks ago bandaged him up. So I don't know where that bandage went. Maybe the bandage is on the inside.
Yeah.
And therefore, the shirt is stained, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, sure. But, like, I mean, like, I assume weeks prior when they thought about this, Esperanza was like, I'll fly the plane. Don't worry. You know, he just, like, throws it out there, and Colonel Stewart and Major Grant are like, all right, the general wants to fly. We trust him to do it. And they're kind of like, I think it's shot. Like, are you good? I'm good. I am going to fly the plane. Like, all right. We're not going to argue with general. We're not going to handle
exactly.
General. Like, all right. Like, they're just like, you got it, boss.
All right. Well, we'll get into that a little bit later this week. There are sure. stuff that come up that will make us want to talk about that also.
Sure.
But we can see that Esperanza is struggling a little bit, but he's basically now struggling because, you know, the aileron is jammed up. You know, that's it's not just because of his arm. He has a good excuse as to why, you know, he's having trouble. You know, it's not me. It's not my arm. It's the aileron, of course.
Yeah, I assumed when he was – the reason he was playing with that is – probably while they were taxiing, they're probably trying to get out. They can't just like sit there and test all the parts. So he's probably like testing that, making sure while eyes are like taxiing and getting out of the hangar. So that's why he had them open. Probably was he's like having to make sure all the systems work before they get on the runway. Cause it's like, we can't hang about, like the ruse is going to be, and we're going to have like, you know, feds and cops here soon enough. So he's like,
there's something. Yeah, I mean, Hal Bryan, who was on earlier this season, would know the answer to this, obviously, because he's a pilot. But my assumption is that, you know, maybe when you're getting ready to take off, you have them open and then you close them right before the takeoff. That's what I would say.
I mean,
but I have no idea.
If I was a pilot and
it's an uneducated guess.
Yeah, uneducated. this is me with a few aircraft video game knowledge. So fair warning. But if I was piloting during a blizzard at night, and they said, "Oh, your plane's good for checking," the first thing I would do is like be playing with that. Yeah, flaps open, and it's like, and with Esperanza and the terrorists, they're like, "We got to get out of here soon. We can't sit here for 15 minutes and play with everything." So he's probably doing it in my mind while they're taxing. He's like steering the plane, taxing, and then he's like in between, like going boop, 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 and he's just kind of playing with each little part of the plane, being like, "All right, that's good. Okay, good. That's not iced down. That engine, that piece is warm. Okay, good." So he's probably doing all that. And yeah, when he's like, "Wait, hold on." Now he's like, "Yeah, something's jamming it up. Like, I could have swore this was working a second ago." And then he's like, "McLean."
Makes sense. That's pretty much how this minute ends. Is there anything else you want to talk about with this minute before we get into the script?
No, I mean, I feel like that. I mean, it's so funny how, yeah, this is McLean's great last ditch. And the terrorists really thought they got away. You know, they thought, We're going to be sandy beaches. We're somehow going to make it out of the airspace. And, like, you know, it really is insane. Like, I want to talk more once again about these soldiers and how, like, they were military trained like a decade ago. They're hunting terrorists, or not terrorists, communists in South America and possibly, you know, as far back as like Vietnam, depending. And it's just like, we trained them for all this for years. And then we were like, abandoned them and just been like, "Yeah, you guys are war criminals now because it's about the war on drugs and we know you guys are moving drugs." You know, the whole Iran Contra with like moving drugs, mm-hmm. guns, and this and that. Like, gotta control terrorism. But wait, the drug war, and it's just like, so. It is that little. I mean, I'm sure you talked about the whole thing with the way back ago with the TV at the beginning when William Sadler is doing judo and stuff in the hotel room. But like
all naked that, tai chi, naked tai naked chi.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, naked tai chi, and just like, you know, like this whole lore dump that you're kind of like, wait, we got a naked man, he's fighting, and you're like, you're the half of you is like, wait, but something on the TV's important. Like you know, that's gonna be important, and like, you know, by the end of this film, and it kind of is. Like, these guys are trained, and they're killing civilians, man. That's the creepiest part. Is at least like Gruber's men were bank robbers. Posing as terrorists, and they didn't care about killing innocents. I think, honestly, the only person that has the best morality might actually be Simon Gruber in Vengeance. He's the only one who's kind of like, "Yeah, I'm not going to kill kids in a school, John. I'm here to make money." You know, like, I feel like he's the only one with the best morals of the entire franchise.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Because I'm thinking Oliphant Oliphant would kill his own men as soon as he doesn't need them.
That's
he's,
right.
He's pretty, like, he pretty, it really doesn't care what happens. He just wants to be proven right at any cost. So I'm really thinking, I think the best morality is actually Simon Gruber in Vengeance. That says something.
And I think that Stewart is probably the most naive of all of them. You know, the because this elaborate plan, which doesn't really make much sense.
No, it doesn't make much sense. And, I mean, if you look at it,
there's too many holes in his plan.
It's one thing to kill a bunch of Euro trash terrorists that show up in L.A. and, you know, but soldiers who are highly trained got took out by a cop. It really does make Colonel Stewart and Grant look bad. Like, all their training, and it's like this one tired, jet-lagged cop who flew in, who's been hanging out with his in-laws all night, you know.
Well, like, let's just talk about a few minor things that I've talked about over the last few weeks, but you know, their planning is so poor that they expected all of their men to still be alive, right? So
yes,
why did they only have five snowmobiles for 13 people? Okay. And then when you look in the cabin of this 747, okay, it's filled and there's like 12 guys there. So where would they have had room for the other 10 that are dead?
Yes, that is so true. Okay, wait. How many snowmobiles you had? Six, was it?
How many what?
How many snowmobiles? Five? Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can fit 10 on there max. Count Esperanza, he's an additional, and comes later.
They were 12 plus Esperanza, so they had 13.
The only thing I can think of is they thought they would still get a hold of the Jeep. Then again, keep this in mind. That was a plan B and a plan C, because they did not believe that
not
the
necessarily
Klan was going to find the church. Like, that was a plan C.
No, I don't think so. I don't agree with you on that, because they knew that part of the plan was for Grant to come and have the fake battle with them. So
I think that's
where they were going to have the fake battle.
I think that's a plan C. I'm sorry, but I think that's a plan C. I think they had plans that, all right, look at this, right? If Barnes and McClane aren't smart, right? McClane's out there, and Barnes is too worried about the lights and not using the outer marker beacon.
Okay.
He's not thinking about the church, is what I'm saying. And you take McClane out of this, right? You take McClane out of this.
They don't even know how close how quickly the guys get there. Before Thompson is killed.
Yeah. So blue light's still called. So let's see. Let's hypothetically take McClane out for a minute. The Annex shootout still happens. The British Airways is still going to crash, because that's pretty much that's Trudeau and Barnes' fault. And a little bit of Lorenzo's. So that's boom. That happens. McClane's not there. They get Esperanza, and Esperanza, maybe if he gets lucky, he doesn't get to take a shot. Maybe he's able. But here's the funny thing is that, no matter where they landed, like, the Esperanza's guard units were still going to get killed by Stewart. So I never understood that part of why he needed to like get them, because he knew, whenever we land, my men are taking control of the airport. They'll just pose as whatever. Sadler will put on his, it's so funny how he's American, but he puts on even a more American accent. Hey, all good, buddy.
He does that because he has to play. He's pretending to be numerous people, because he's basically, passing it from one controller to another controller, which is what you have to do. That we talked about back then.
Okay, that's good. All right, good.
I think according to the script, the reason, I mean, according to how the script was set up, the reason that Esperanza had to kill, the muchacho and then the two pilots, that was part of the plan, because then we're able to know that Esperanza knows how to fly a plane.
Yeah, that's true. And obviously he had a radio stored somewhere in the cockpit.
That's right. Yeah, under the dashboard.
Yeah, so he knew that too. It's just dangerous. I'm just saying it's unnecessarily dangerous, in my opinion. If he would have just landed, Stewart would have posed as airport control, and then they could pose as security teams out on runway, whatever the original runway was going to be, and just tell the foreign military, sorry about the storm, we had to land you here. By the way, we're terrorists, bam, 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 and they get General Esperanza. But the point is, I think, Barnes and McClane have not found the church, is what I'm trying to get at. That's the whole point I'm trying to get at. So what I think would have happened is,
I knew where you're going with that. That's great.
Okay,
that's a great way you're thinking about this.
I think they would have taken the Jeep, and they would have gotten some guys already out by the hangar. They're waiting on Grant. And
They have a van also, because the van that they showed up at the church at the beginning.
Yes. Yes, they clearly took out some
when Thompson and Baker showed up. That's right.
That is true. So they have a van, they have a Jeep, they have the snowmobiles, and they could also, here's another plan they could have done, pretended to be arrested by Grant, so Grant's men hold them captive, and then they, when they throw them in the back of the truck, they can then just drive them to the hangar and uncuff them, hypothetically.
Right, okay. That's true.
That's why I always sit with, I'm always like, I think they had several plans. Like, Gruber has essentially a plan A and plan B and maybe plan C, which is like, get the hostages, they go to the roof, they get the code maybe from Takagi, and they're going to blow the roof, and then they're going to escape from the ambulance. That's pretty much his plan. McClane messes with it. I think between Colonel Stewart and Major, knowing that they have to dupe an entire airport police and possibly federal officers from foreign military, I feel like, they have at least like four backup plans. Which is why when they say those code lines, like, we have a situation, it's kind of like them saying, we've now proceeded to the next alternate plan phase. Change out your magazines, clear guns, let's put the blanks in and put on a good show. I have more to say, but let's say that for next episode.
All right. Sounds good. So the script is very, very short for this particular scene. Actually, for this whole week, there isn't much in the script because it's mostly descriptive. But so it basically says McClane sitting on the skid of this of the helicopter drops to a handhold as the skids come treacherously close to the plane wing. McClane's feet grope for the wing surface. But the two aircraft, one still earthbound, move apart. Pause. McClane tries again and makes it. The chopper peels away and vanishes into the snowstorm. McClane, panting, wedges himself against an engine pod and starts to take off his jacket. Inside the cockpit, Esperanza lights a cigar and then looks out the window and frowns. So the whole conversation between Sam Coleman and John doesn't appear in the script.
Okay.
So it's interesting that they did that. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called McClane Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So what do you got for us, Dave?
Okay. So I wanted to be, you know, try to have a few different takes than people in the past. So I'll start the top with the top two, Unbreakable and Die Hard.
Wait, 1 second. You're starting at, those are number one and two.
Number one and two. Start at the top. Cause I think I want to save my other ones because they're a little bit more of off the beaten path. So we'll start with Unbreakable. Right. This movie makes me cry every time. I cry every time during this movie. Like you play the soundtrack. I'm thinking about the soundtrack right now.
I love
I'm already
the
getting
soundtrack.
Tears.
Wow.
Like I can feel it, my sinuses. That's how like memory hold I am to seeing Unbreakable and hearing that soundtrack.
Wow.
I remember when Shyamalan talked about making it, and he was like, I wanted to make a story about like Superman not knowing he was Superman. Like a real like he was on Earth and he didn't know his purpose and he didn't know he was Superman. I wanted to tell the story that way rather than like Pa Kent telling him he was able to find out, but he's almost like, you know, middle age at this point. So him finding that out, the whole, I mean, everywhere from like finding out what the Orange Man does all the way until like the next morning when he's like quietly whispering to his son. I mean, he, the wife and him are having trouble. He carries her up to sleep. He feels like the best he's ever felt in years. He feels like he has a purpose. That whole thing, even until the handshake with Sam Jackson and Mr. Glass, I'm in tears. That movie somehow always gets me. And anecdotally off of that, when I was watching Split, I'm like, I'm enjoying Split. I saw Split alone. No one would see with me. So Cherry Hill, that January, that movie's in theaters. I'm in the theater. It's like me, there's like maybe 20, 30 people in the theater. Two of them are like this older couple, and they are talking throughout the whole film. They're like, what is he saying? Why is he doing that? I don't know, lady. He's crazy, okay? Like, he's got a lot of personalities, okay? So, like, I didn't say that, but I'm thinking that. I'm just like, I'm trying to enjoy the M. Night Shyamalan film in front of me, lady. And then I remember him, so I remember, you know, we get near the end. Spoilers for Split, by the way. is that he turns into the Beast. I'm like, yes! Because I was like, okay. Like, now we've jumped from, like, oh, this could be a real medical condition to, like, we're now fully in the Shyamalan territory. We've kind of, like, breached that wall. We're in, like, the fantasy stuff that he does when he, like, there's that moment when he breaks the seal and it's like, go surreal, baby. You know, when he does that.
Right.
It's like, I'm like, yes, I'm 100% in now. And then, you know, Anya Taylor-Joy trying to run, yada, yada, yada. And at the end of the film, when he's talking to himself and he's like, he will know what to do and protect us. I started crying. I'm like, why am I crying? I don't know why I'm crying. What I'd realize, I'm thinking about it right now, I'm already crying. I can feel my sinuses once again, is they're playing the James Newton Howard theme from Unbreakable. And my brain knew it, but I didn't know it. And that's what's insane.
Oh, wow.
And so like, right now, my sinuses are already starting to tear up. And I'm just sitting in the theater being like, I'm overcome with emotion right now, and I don't know why. And so it cuts to the diner scene, and they're like, we're going to call him the Beast. And then the ladies are like, there's another guy. And I'm like, wait a second. And I just remember, you hear the Mr. Glass. It all comes. Hold on. Oh, God, my son. Give me a second. It gets me every time. And then, yeah, when the camera pans to Bruce Willis, you see it says, done. I just start to go, like that. Just absolutely screaming in the theater. I started like slamming the back of my chair. Everyone's looking at me like I had an absolute emotional stab because I was like, holy shit, I didn't know this twist. And I was like losing my mind. I was like, no one got it. No one was getting it. I'm hyperventilating. I'm like that. Like, I was like, what a f-ing twist. I can't get over that. Oh my God. That's how much I love Unbreakable. And how Bruce Willis gets me every time is the fact the f-ing score is used years later in Split. I haven't even thought about Unbreakable. I think the last time I heard Unbreakable was like when Patton Oswalt was talking about that, like, oh, M. Night Shyamalan should make a sequel to Unbreakable. And we're all like, yeah, he should. And that was like years prior to this even. Like, that was like 2012 Patton Oswalt was like talking about it on podcasts. So that's how much that movie's like got me. If you say like one Bruce Willis movie you have to keep, it's going to be Unbreakable. I had to choose that over Die Hard, how much it absolutely just like grips me every time. So then boom, we got number two, Die Hard. Die Hard, he's got to carry this film, and he's like not known. And we heard all the stories about how it's like he was like eighth guy on the list. He's just a TV comedy actor. What does he know? And the fact that like this whole like East Coast attitude meets West Coast, you know, nonsense. It's amazing how much it works. It's one of these things where I love the film absolutely, but I don't know what else I can say new about it. Not 1,000 other people have said. It's why we keep arguing every Christmas whether it's a Christmas movie, and it is. It's a Reagan era Western. It's a Reagan era Western Christmas. Like, it's like all about cowboys and ranches, like white hats, black hats, the FBI are gray hats. Like, they all have their cowboy mentalities to them, and it's if you look at it that way, where it's like he's got to protect the ranch, which is his family. And he has, you know, foreign invaders. He's got European terrorists. And he can't trust the authorities to do the job, the FBI and the police. He has to take it upon himself. It's something where it's like those moments in the movie, he doesn't even need to be an FDR cop. He could just be a guy who finds himself, luckily, you know, outside the party. So,
right.
But it works. It all works. And it's great. My number three is Last Boy Scout. I love Joe Hollenbeck. I love his "You're Gonna Lose, Everybody Hates You, Smile You." I love when he does that in the mirror, and that's how like we start the film. I love that. Like, I feel that if you're ever doing a Die Hard trilogy marathon, you're like, oh, what do you get? I say add this after Die Hard 2. I feel like this is a good cynical Bruce Willis to add right there, where you can almost pretend this could be the same type of vibe that Holly's having, where it's like the marriage just isn't, like, he tried, it's not working anymore. Like, you can pretend that's Lucy McLean. Like, sure, there's no young John, there's no John Jr., but at least you could pretend like that could be Lucy McLean. He's not, you know, she's not growing up right, you know, she's got a violent temper like her father. So there's moments that Shane Black feels like he's kind of like, no, I'm going to write a little McLean moments in here where he's just absolutely a cynical SOB, and him and his wife are just constantly at each other's throats. And then I think when you go into Die Hard with a Vengeance, it feels even smoother. It's less of a like, oh, no, he's back to New York. It's like, yeah, I'm sure, like, oh, my God, I love Die Hard with a Vengeance. And I know Niall's already talked about it, so I don't want to, like, talk about the fact that me and Niall talk about it. But the fact that, like, that's the best supporting cast, I always think about that supporting cast being like, yeah, in the universe, it'd be like, oh, John's marriage fell apart, he's back to New York. Oh, okay, yeah, we kept his desk empty because we knew he'd be back here, like, within 2 or 3 years. And suddenly, God, here he is. That's just such a scene that we don't see in this film, is that, like, what is John McClane's LAPD life? Like, I guess he's on the streets. I guess it's like, did Walter Cobb give him a good, like, recommendation to, like, move out to L.A.? And I'm guessing maybe, like, LAPD's like, well, I guess, like, this New York cop, like, hero cop, it's good PR to have him on the force. It's kind of one of these things, and they just, like, him slowly, like, no, actually, I do hate L.A. I can't handle this. You know, just, and then he brings that vibe home with his wife. So that's my reason for Last Boy Scout. It feels like it can fit right in between Die Hard 2 and 3, and you'd be like, cool. So my 4 and 5 is when I wanted to try something else. So I went with an old favorite of mine, Miami Vice Season 1, Episode 8, No Exit. This might be Bruce Willis's first serious role prior to Die Hard, because I think this is even early in his moonlighting days. So Bruce Willis plays a weapons dealer, and he's also an abusive husband. And so Sonny Crockett and Tubbs, they've been slowly trying to work the case because they know he's moving arms, and they're trying to make sure they get a bus. They're trying to get him with actual, like, he's got surface-to-air missiles. And they're like, that's having surface-to-air missiles that could be fired out of Miami is incredibly dangerous. So they're trying to keep their cover and try to build the case. Meanwhile, Sonny Crockett knows the wife is getting beat nightly by Bruce Willis. And he's like, she's like, I want to run away. He's like, I can't have you run away. I need this case. I will get you into witness protection. I will, like, I want to try to get you on the stand and you can say that this and that. And so he's like trying to tell her, like, because she kind of realizes and he admits, he's like, look, I'm an undercover. Like, I want to get you out of here, but I need, like, give me like another week and I'm going to bust him. And spoilers for this episode, but it's really cool. Essentially, they nail it. They nail Bruce Willis. Now he's got some lawyers and he's going to do a little perp walk. So Bruce Willis, he looks exactly like his moonlighting date. He dresses like in these like nice shirts, but he's an absolute monster. Like, he's an absolute evil man. And so when he does that smirk coming out of the courthouse, you're like, you're scum. You are absolute pond scum. And Sonny Crockett he has exactly the same face. He's sitting there with his shades, and him and Tubbs got their arms folded. Like, this guy's scummy. Like, he's going to walk right now, but like, we're going to make sure the federal case is on him. Like, his lawyers can't dodge like this and that. And he sees with a corner of his eye, the wife is getting out of a car, and he's like slow motions. She's on the other side of the courthouse steps. She's reaching to her purse. She's pulling out like a .38 revolver, and Sonny's like, whoa, and he just like cuts to like her, like essentially doing like the Lee Harvey Oswald shot where she just like hits him in the gut on the courthouse steps. And it's like, and Sonny's like running over, and that's it. Cut the credits. You're like, she's going to get arrested for shooting him in public. And I assume Sonny's going to have to like be some kind of character witness for her to be like, no, she's absolutely abused. Like, I was a witness to it. Like, when I was doing, I don't know, does he have to like blow his own cover to do that? I don't know. But it is a really good, like, mm-hmm. early in the season show that showed that like Bruce Willis could absolutely play an evil man. So I wanted to give people that, like, give you a little option. Like, go check this out if you can find it. I bought the box set a while ago, so I'm like, yeah, I'm a big fan of it, Michael Mann. And my fifth one is I wanted to go even more off the beat path. I chose his Ocean's 12 cameo because he gets to play himself and he gets to make fun of Julia Roberts, who is playing Tess Ocean, who is pretending to be Julia Roberts. And it's like, the reason that movie upsets a lot of people is like they broke the unwritten rule of you can't say the actors look like the actors. Like, we're told since watching movies, no. For the next 2 hours, you're pretending that this actor is playing a character who's not an actor. And so when they decide to, like, Steven Soderbergh's like, yeah, we're doing it, you're like, I don't know, I feel uncomfortable. You're breaking the rule. You're breaking that fourth wall on a story level. And the fact that, like, you have Matt Damon and, like, John Cheadle, and they're all George Clooney, they're all surrounded, but they're not the actors. They're just the heisters. They have to pretend to be her agents and stuff. And then Bruce Willis is there, and he's like, Julia, how you doing? And he's, like, riffing on bits. He's, like, kind of like the player where he's just, like, they're having fun like they were years ago. And, like, now Julia Roberts has to pretend like she's, like, you know, that she's her. And I thought, like, the movie is such – it's breaking. It's like the seams of, like, what a film is breaking because we're breaking all the fourth walls of, like, what a conventional movie's supposed to be. And they're like, no, the actor, she does look like her. And a real actor's now addressing that. And the real actor's looking at Matt Damon, but Matt Damon's not Matt Damon. He's playing a heister who has to be – pretend to be her agent in front of Bruce Willis. And so, like, Bruce just playing off of all of that. He gets to play, like – the dub Hollywood actor who likes to run to the Europe and they like to, you know, meet in lobbies of art galleries. It's just so silly and fun that I'm like, I think that should be referenced, like, that Bruce Willis could get to play himself and be an absolute goofball. But the tone of the film is that, oh no, Bruce Willis is here. What do we do? Is such a fun little thing.
Makes sense.
Thank you. When I thought about this at the beginning, I was like, I got to bring Movie Rob some real ones. I can't just say, like, oh, I like him and this and that. Like, I gotta juice it a bit. I got to give him something. We're near the end of the film. We got to put some new life in it.
You definitely juiced it. Yeah, you did. Thank you very much for that, Dave. So you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yes. Yeah. Hey, if you like me spouting off hours about nonsense, my podcast, 5 Minutes of Mystery, if you haven't heard about it, I talk about the 1999 superhero comedy ensemble Mystery Men. I am working on stuff. I am working on an epilogue. I've promised the fans, just buy me time. Like, just listen to all these other great Movies by Minutes podcasts. Don't worry. And when I have it all ready for you, we're going to have some fun. You know, keep subscribed. I promise. But yeah, other than that, yeah, you can find me at 5 Minutes of Mystery on Twitter. If you want to talk about any comic book nonsense or movie nonsense, I'm happy to hear about it. So, you know, thank you for having me on. This is going to be a fun week. I'm excited, looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages,